This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Today our topic is Change and Continuity, the general elections of 1922 and 1923. What do these two elections tell us about Ireland's political landscape before and after the Civil War? To address this question, I'm joined by Elaine Callanan, lecturer in history at Carlow College and author of Electioneering and Propaganda in Ireland, 1917 to 1921, Votes, Violence and Victory. And that was published by Four Courts Press in 2020. Mel Farrell, also a lecturer in history at Carlow College and author of Party Politics in a New Democracy, The Irish Free State, 1922 to 1937, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Michael Laffin, Emeritus Professor of History at University College Dublin and author of The Resurrection of Ireland, The Sinn Féin Party, 1916 to 1923, published by Cambridge University Press in 2012. And finally, Martin O'Donoghue, Visiting Fellow in the Arts and Humanities Institute, Maynooth University, and author of The Legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party in Independent Ireland, 1922 to 1949, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, Michael, as a senior man on our panel here, I want to go to you first. Could you briefly sketch out the political landscape, you know, in broad strokes, before the revolutionary period, so we know what we're comparing with, if you like?
Well, there had been a long period of stability with two main parties, the Irish Parliamentary Party, the Nationalist Party, and the Ulster Unionists, with a few Southern Unionists, very, very few. And they dominated Irish political life to such an extent that, by and large, they didn't worry about competition. Very many seats with Ulster and in the other three provinces were uncontested, and the Nationalist or the Unionist would have a free one. So there wasn't much incentive for parties to organise against a strong opponent, with the result that, in the case in particular of the Home Rule Party, It got flabby, it got weak, it got vulnerable. It didn't need to fight for votes, therefore it let its machinery go rusty. So it was ready for an onslaught by a formidable opponent, which it didn't face until 1917 or 1918, and then, as we all know, it was wiped out by the new Sinn Féin Party.
Mel, can I bring you in on this, right? I mean, just talk to us about the voting system, because it was the Westminster first passed the post. What effect did that have on the political landscape?
Indeed, there was just so much change really in this period, and one of the major ones, obviously, the franchise changes dramatically in this period. You know, in 1918, you have the trebling of the electorate, and then obviously by the 1923 election, the Free State, you have universal adult suffrage, men and women voting on an equal basis, but also the voting system changes. So obviously, as part of the UK, Ireland had the first past the post voting system up until independence. So people voted by placing an X on the ballot paper next to their preferred candidate in single seat constituencies. So somebody voting in 1918, who is also voting in 1922, 23, they have to change how they vote, have to learn a whole new voting system with the introduction of proportional representation via the single transferable vote in multi-seat constituencies. Of course, ironically, proportional representation was actually brought in by the British in 1920 for the 1920 local elections in the hope that it would dilute the nationalist voters, inhibit the strength of Sinn Féin's vote in the 1920 local elections. So obviously, proportional representation has been retained. It was retained in the Free State Constitution in 1922, and much to the delight, I think, of election enthusiasts who like the long counts.
Martin, can I bring you in this? Because Michael has mentioned the wiping out of the Irish Parliamentary Party in the 1918 general election. I mean, you get the impression that the Irish Parliamentary Party just disappears, but you know, where do its voters go subsequently?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'm supposed to say is that the voters abandon the party in stages and that some of them don't actually go. So, I mean, initially, early Sinn Féin raises a challenge and some Irish party, a handful of Irish party and members and a couple of MPs stand down in 1907. But really, the Irish party has kept things cohesive by the 1910 elections and at the outset of the First World War. But the Rising obviously brings about a big political change that many people might be familiar with when you think of the by-elections and the big victories of Count Plunkett and Sinn Féin candidates against the Irish Party. But the Irish Party still had some of its support by then. I mean, some of these by-elections, you know, the Irish Party still polled well, and they turned the tide a little bit in some of the elections, particularly in Ulster, before the general election of 1918. So there's a staging point at 1916 where they lose support. Then obviously they lose more support, particularly after the conscription crisis. By the 1918 general election, they're reduced down to obviously 6 seats in the island of Ireland and 1 in the United Kingdom. But the voting system is important. Mel talked about proportional representation a second ago. First past the post ruthlessly punishes the Irish Parliamentary Party in 1918, even accounting for uncontested constituencies. When you look at the constituencies that are contested, and I'm drawing here from Michael's book on Sinn Féin, the Irish Party's proportional support is not that different to Fine Gael at its electoral nadir in the 1940s, or indeed Fianna Fáil in 2011. So there's still support there, but the Irish Party outside of Ulster effectively withdraws from electoral politics after this point. The Irish Party retains a greater support in Ulster. But when it comes to the 1921 elections for what was going to be called Southern Ireland, obviously it turned out to be a dead letter, and what was reconstituted then as the Second Dáil, John Dillon, the last Irish Party leader, and Captain William Redmond, John Redmond's son, they withdraw. So at that point then, you have Irish Party supporters on the sidelines through the War of Independence and Civil War, even though they still have more support in Ulster. And I suppose this is where the other point that Michael made comes to the fore, which is the fact that the Irish Party wasn't used to electoral competition by 1910, 1914 in many constituencies. It was used to more competitive elections in Ulster and in the northern half of the country. It had its Catholic fraternal body, the Ancient Order of Hibernians. And actually, the Irish Party does better in 1918 in Ulster constituencies. Joe Devlin manages to defeat Eamon de Valera in Belfast Falls. And even accounting for the electoral pact that Cardinal Logue brokered, you can see still stronger support for the Irish Party. And its machinery ultimately couldn't be defeated by Sinn Féin, because then when you have elections for the Northern Parliament for 1921, you have this alliance of the old nationalists, as they soon come to be called, with Sinn Féin. But outside of that, John Dillon and others, they don't want to be seen to be taking the side of the British government as violence erupts in the country. And the Irish Party supporters are left on the sidelines, and they have to sort of be picked up again then when the Free State arrives. So from 1922, they tend to go towards independent candidates. They might have some Home Rule links, Farmers' Party, some perhaps of William O'Brien's movement can find their way into the Labour Party. And Cumann na Gael does try to attract former Home Rule supporters from 1922. But again, there's staging posts in terms of how they can attract former home rulers. And many are still reluctant to actually go and support Cumann na Gael. There's still a lot of distrust about 1916, about Sinn Féin's actions, a feeling that John Redmond's been maligned and that the Irish Party was unceremoniously knocked off its political perch, if you like.
It's funny you should mention support going to Cumann na Gael, because John Bruton, when he was leader of Fine Gael, often tried to establish an apostolic succession, which in many respects wasn't there, actually, because Fine Gael are descended from Sinn Féin, actually, like most Indeed. Political parties on this island. Now, Elaine, I want to bring you in here on the role of women, right? Because the women over 30 get the vote in 1918 in the Westminster election. Did that mean that women didn't participate in elections before that time?
No, well, they would have actually participated in elections from, roughly speaking, the late 1800s with the Local Government of Ireland Act of 1898. And this actually granted men over the age of 21 and women over the age of 30 the right to vote in local elections. Women at that point in time could also stand for election to urban and rural district councils, but they were disqualified from serving on borough and county councils until 1911 or thereabouts. But it began to give women a voice in politics, and it certainly began to educate them in the role of politics itself. And we really see that coming to the fore in the 1918 Representation of the People Act. And this, as was already pointed out by Mel, greatly introduced the electorate that had heretofore been ineligible to vote. So you have women over 30 now able to vote in general elections and be able to run as candidates in those elections.
Did many avail of that opportunity, in fact, though?
No. Actually, in 1918, you only have two women candidates. You have Constance Markievicz in Dublin and Winifred Kearney up in Belfast. And the only one that actually gets a seat is, or gets elected, is Constance Markievicz. But it does change, as was pointed out in 1922, when all women were granted the right to vote under the terms of the Constitution of the Irish Free State in exactly the same manner as men. And we see a slight increase at that stage in terms of women candidates.
Now, Elaine, the Irish Parliamentary Party opposed extending the franchise to women, right? Now, is there any evidence, anecdotal or otherwise, that the women were waiting in the long grass for them in 1918?
Well, I mean, certainly, I mean, if you look at the suffrage movement, there was a lot of campaigning for votes. And one of the fears, I think, of the Irish Parliamentary Party was that if they granted the vote to women in, you know, prior to 1918, it might have affected the outcome of the Home Rule idea. And they really wanted to maintain the status quo in order to push Home Rule through. But it didn't serve them well, that decision, because it came back to bite them in 1918, I would argue, because women, as is reported on in the newspapers, and that's really where we get a lot of our information on how women acted in this period, shows that there was a very good turnout of women for the 1918 general election, as there was for 1922 and 23. And, you know, those women certainly were not going to cast their votes, we believe, for the, I mean, some would, but for the Irish Parliamentary Party. And a lot of the female votes seemed to go to Sinn Féin in 1918. And on the other side, I mean, that Sinn Féin and the Irish Parliamentary Party were also contesting against unionists. And unionist women were powerful in terms of coming out to vote in elections as well. And that vote served both unionists and Sinn Féin very well in 1918.
Now, I want to just talk about the votes for women in the 1922 election, right? Because there was a whole controversy. I mean, which women had the right to vote in the 1922 election? Was it on the same basis as men, or was it the old electoral register, the 1918 electoral register?
It was actually the old electoral register in 1922. Really, the impact of the change doesn't come through until the 1923 election.
Why was there heel dragging on this question? Why weren't women admitted to the franchise on an equal level in 1922? What was the fear?
I don't know precisely what the fear was, because nobody ever really talks about what the actual fear was. But I think it still leaned back into this whole idea of how women would vote. And in 1922, even though it was a packed election, you know, there was fear that women could upset the apple cart, because a lot of the women that were contesting or running or active in 1922 were very much on the Republican side as opposed to the treaty side. So that probably, you know, impeded this jump into admitting women. And now that did change by 1923. But even at that, you know, Republican women are going to have problems in 1923 in terms of being able to take up their seats, because, of course, you know, De Valera, Sinn Féin are going to abstain from taking their seats in Dáil Éireann.
So what you're saying is there was an assumption on the pro-treaty side that the anti-treaty women, who were very vocal in the treaty debates and so on, that they were representative of women in general.
Well, even if they weren't representative of women in general, they certainly were able to perhaps mobilise an awful lot stronger than the anti-treaty side. Now, you did have powerful women on the anti-treaty side as well, like the likes of Jenny Wise Power. But they seemed to be numerically lower than those on the Republican side, or if not even numerically lower, they were certainly quieter.
Now, Michael, you want to come in on that, on the women question?
Yes. I agree with everything that Elaine has said, of course. There was one other little point, and that was in 1922, the Republicans were determined not to have an election on the treaty. They wanted to postpone one as long as possible so that other issues would distract the electorate, the voters, from the treaty. If they were to establish a new register giving women the vote on the same terms as men, it would have postponed the election by months. They were deterred. They, Collins, Griffith, and pro-treaty government, the provisional government, were determined to have an election as soon as possible, even though the circumstances weren't propitious. And Arthur Griffith said, it's not ideal. We want women to get to vote on equal terms with men. We will do this in the Constitution. We can't do it now, but we promise it will come into effect as soon as possible. And that was done. It came into effect.
So, Michael, why would it have delayed elections? Is that just the bureaucratic question of, you know, redoing the register? Is just a bureaucratic question?
No, compiling a register would take a long time.
And, okay.
Compiling the register was also, or maintaining the register was difficult because some of the Republicans were determined to seize and they threatened to destroy voting registers. So it was a very sensitive issue in the early summer, midsummer of 1922. And Griffith took the view. Griffith had always supported votes for women. He had done it way back in the early years of the century. He said, yes, we want it, but not now, because it will just be a further complication. We will do it as soon as possible. And I said, it was done as soon as possible, just a year later.
Now, Elaine has mentioned the packed election, the 1922 general election. Michael, what do we mean by a packed election? Well, it's P-A-C-T, by the way.
The Republicans were terrified of an election on the treaty. They knew they were an unpopular minority. And this is not a matter of dispute. De Valera, Stack, all the others wrote and said in private, we are a minority. We are going to lose a vote on the treaty. Let's have a vote on something else, on, say, a new constitution. And eventually an agreement was reached between De Valera and Collins, laying down that an election would take place in June 22. But the treaty would not be an issue. The two factions in Sinn Féin, pro and anti-treaty, would run exactly as many candidates as they had in the Dáil already. That meant 64 pro-treaty, 57 anti-treaty. So as Harry Boland said, there is no issue at stake in this election. Some people, Arthur Griffith in particular, were shocked at what they regarded as a scandalous abuse of democracy, an attack on democracy. But Collins took the view it's the only way to hold an election. If we don't make an agreement with the Republicans, they will prevent an election taking place by seizing registers, perhaps even killing candidates. However, the key element in the pact was this. The two Sinn Féin factions wouldn't fight each other, but other parties would be allowed run for election. And this was in contrast to just a year earlier, in May 1921, when the second Dáil was elected, and in the whole 26 counties, the future Free State, every candidate was returned unopposed. Now, in 22, third-party candidates, Labour, Farmers and Independents, would be entitled to run, and their participation in the election turned out to be absolutely crucial.
Now, just what kind of figures? I mean, how many constituencies were there, for example, in the 22 election, and how many of them were uncontested? Now, when I say uncontested, presumably people would go through the motions of putting their 1, 2, 3, 4 on a ballot paper, or were they simply were the same number of candidates as there were seats in the various constituencies? The uncontested constituencies, I mean,
in 7 out of 28 constituencies. There were just as many candidates as there were seats, so there was no need for an election. They were all deemed elected automatically. And these were mainly in the West. And there's almost an unbroken line running from Donegal to Kerry, with a break in County Galway, of seats where there were no contests. So it was, everybody agreed, an imperfect election. But the fact that most of the seats, three-quarters of the constituencies, sorry, not seats, three-quarters of the constituencies were contested, did mean that there was a fairly representative result. And the result was a massive, decisive victory for the treaty, as Collins had expected, even though his party, his wing of Sinn Féin, did lose several seats to other third-party candidates. But the main victim, in that election was the Republicans. They performed absolutely disastrously.
No, but I mean, part of that, presumably, Mike, was because the pact was repudiated by the pro-treaty side at the last minute.
Yes, the pro-treaty side wasn't enthusiastic at all. And Collins, at the very end, made a speech in Cork in which he said voters should vote for the candidates they thought best. Well, under normal circumstances, that wouldn't be particularly controversial. Naturally, the pro-treaty, sorry, the anti-treaty side, the Republicans, were resentful of that. But they had engaged in dodgy practices as well. Both sides had, if you like, dirty hands in the election. So Collins did pull a fast one on De Valera. He showed himself to be a cute, maybe dishonest politician, and in this case, a successful one, in that he got the large majority in the Dáil, even if he was dependent on non-Sinn Féin TDs. But remember, every non-Sinn Féin candidate who ran for election in 1922 supported the treaty. So that meant that every Labour or farmer or independent TD was an ally of Collins on the key issue of the day. So Collins had very good reason to be pleased with the result of the pact.
Now, just going back to those Western constituencies, Michael, the uncontested ones, right? Presumably there were people, you know, non-Sinn Féin people, pro-anti-treaty, who wanted to stand. And if so, why didn't they?
Intimidation is the main answer. People were discouraged, to put it mildly, from running. In one case in Tipperary, a farmer, and the farmers were the main victims of Republican intimidation. A farmer was besieged at night in his farmhouse, wounded, dragged out, and forced to withdraw. After that ordeal, he probably wasn't particularly inclined to carry on in the fight. So a lot of people were discouraged from running. And the result was that the Republicans were able to get more seats than would otherwise have been the case in an open election because of their massive anti-Republican pro-treaty vote that took place on the 16th of June.
Now, I want to bring in Elaine in here, because the question I want to ask Elaine is, okay, Michael has talked about intimidation, problem, violence or the threat of violence, but was that not the norm in previous elections, right? I mean, you know, how much more violent were things in 1922 than previously?
Well, actually, not as violent as 1918, where you see a lot of physical violence in the election campaigns. Violence was a common feature of Irish elections, particularly outside polling booths and amongst audiences at campaign speeches. And here you'd see rival detachments of volunteers often carrying hurleys readied for defence or combat. And in 1918, the constituencies of Waterford and Mayo witnessed a high level of violence during the campaign, where you see bottles and stones being hurled by both sides. As I said, in 1922, violence, as Michael did point out, came more in the form of intimidation, particularly of those non-panel candidates. And we see this, you know, we guess at this in many ways because some of the candidates in the Farmers and Labour parties did stand down, while it is difficult to prove. But at the outset, both parties had nominated more candidates than eventually stood. And some examples of this kind of intimidation was an attack made on the home of the Longford Westmead ratepayers or independent candidate, Patrick Belton, who did not withdraw, but he didn't secure a seat. And in Carlow Kilkenny, the Farmers' Party candidate and leader, Dennis Gorey, was attacked and fired upon. And he too stood his ground and didn't withdraw his candidacy. And he went on to attain a seat, getting votes just under the quota. And another who stood his ground was Darrell Figgis of Dublin County, who ran as an independent. And his flat in Kildare Street, Dublin, was invaded at midnight on the 12th of June by three youths. And Michael Gallagher also points out this whole idea of moral pressure, which is put upon these non-panel candidates. And at a Sinn Féin conference in Tipperary North, South and Mid, it was stated that any candidates that opposed the panel were disruptionist and anti-national in the present crisis. So Patrick Hogan and Clare was targeted and asked to stand down in the interests of national unity, and he ultimately withdrew. So while there wasn't the same kind of rally violence that you might have seen in 1918, by 1922, you have this kind of intimidation. But 1923 is surprisingly quiet. And despite the discord between Cumann na Gael and Sinn Féin, this election really passes off quite peacefully.
Now, Martin, you want to come in on that point?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I agree with everything Elaine's saying. And certainly the violence is much more marked in 1922 than 23. And I think that's commented upon in the newspapers, that 23 becomes more normal, for want of a better term. I suppose what I was going to say was there was a history of violence at elections all through the period of the Irish parliamentary parties. Dominance, if you like, obviously there was violence during the Parnell split. Indeed, there was violence before that and going back before the Secret Ballot Act. There was a lot of issues at election time. But certainly this was something that did affect independents and other non-party candidates. And it also, I suppose, helped discourage John Dillon from any thoughts of resurrecting the Irish Parliamentary Party. He got what he called, in a letter to T.P. O'Connor, friendly warnings from Republicans. The election would be a very savage and ugly business and it's better to stay out of it. So I think it affected all of the sort of the non-panel, the non-Sinn Féin would-be candidates that they weren't to go forward in 1922, despite the fact that many of those involved in agrarian movements or in home rule movements would have had experience of violence at election time. But of course, many of these people now are older and they've got less support, which obviously, you know, is more of an even disadvantage if you have to fight back sort of violence at election time as well. But I suppose it's still striking the point that the non-Sinn Féin vote is still very strong in 1922. Labour really are very successful at the polls, which is striking, and it's been discussed in the last History Ireland Hedge School. Perhaps they're less deterred by the intimidation than farmers' candidates, independent candidates, or former home rulers. But it is noteworthy that there, as was discussed in the last Hedge School, there's still a proportion of voters that maybe are a little bit standing aside from the Civil War, that want to vote on bread and butter issues, not just the issue of the treaty, even if, as Michael said, anyone who wasn't standing as a Republican was ultimately willing to accept the treaty and the Dáil as the national forum of Parliament.
Yeah, Mel, could you come in on that question of the non-Sinn Féin vote? Because, as I say, on the Republican side, there was this idea, this aspiration that they hoped that the election wouldn't be about the treaty. And in some respects, it wasn't. It's not, you know, in terms of the size of the non-Sinn Féin vote. Just talk to us a bit about that.
Indeed. I mean, Martin just took the words out of my mouth there. I agree with everything that he just said. I mean, the performance really of the non-Sinn Féin candidates was really quite remarkable in the June 1922 election. And I suppose a few moments ago, Martin had talked about how first past the post had really punished the home rulers in 1918, 1922 in those constituencies that were contested. Obviously, now you've got proportional representation. So maybe that issue that he talked about at the outset comes to the fore, that, you know, you have that representation to that non-Sinn Féin vote that is in in the 26th county area, to use that terminology. But obviously, in terms of you also have the threat of civil war hanging in the air, the threat of renewed violence. And really, from 1916 to 1922, you've had so much upheaval, you know, so much conflict. I think there was a sort of a mood against militarism as well, which maybe is reflected. Obviously, in your last Hedge School, you talked about that in relation to the Labour Party. And of course, just as a bloc, the non-Sinn Féin candidates, you know, 34 TDs essentially elected from outside, the Sinn Féin, the two Sinn Féin factions, 17 Labour, 7 Farmers, 10 others, including a business party.
What was the total number of seats? Just give me what was the total number of seats in the 22?
I want to say 128. Can anyone, am I correct there?
And how many non-Sinn Féin then were out of the 128?
34.
Okay, that's like about a quarter, isn't it?
Yeah, so like the anti-treatyites returned 36 TDs. So, right. Which kind of shows you that the non-Sinn Féin bloc was a significant bloc.
There's another point I want to raise here, because in most elections in this state, the largest constituencies will be 5-seaters. But in these elections, you're talking about, 7-8-seat constituencies. Is that correct? You know, large constituencies.
That's correct, and that's the case in the 20s itself. you know, you've got constituents like Dublin North, Dublin South, Galway, you know.
And obviously then the trend was towards smaller constituents, five being the max usually. I mean, you don't get constituents more than five these days. Because the point is that the larger the number of seats, the more balkanized, if you like, the politics becomes, does it not? I mean, it allows more space for independents to get elected.
That's very true, absolutely. Now, funny enough, in the 1923 election, you know, that doesn't really come to the fore. Cumann na Gael, actually, in 1923, not to go off the point, performed very well in those large, you know, constituencies, you know, taking four of the eight seats in Dublin North, for example. So, you know, having a big vote getter, you know, that can, you know, transfer the vote and bring in running mates on maybe, you know, only 700 or 800 votes. You know, the famous one obviously is De Valera and Clare in 1923, you know, his surplus bringing in Brian O'Higgins, who got around 100 first preferences. So, I suppose it kind of works itself out, you know, differently in those larger constituencies to that extent. But I just wanted to make the point about, what this, vote for the non Sinn Féin candidates kind of represents in 1922, and I think it shows really a desire to get back to normality, get back to socio-economic issues, and really it's about reflecting the extent to which a large number of people stood outside of the treaty dispute in 1922 as well.
Mel, one other question I'd ask is: do we have the figures for these elections? Like, can we analyze where transfers went and so on and so forth? Do they still exist for historians to study?
I might hand that one over to Elaine, actually.
She's
more of an expert on that than I am.
Are the figures still available to crunch and re-crunch?
They are actually, in some instances, but not in all. And you're very much reliant on newspaper coverage to actually give you that information. To see where people actually land in terms of getting elected. Now, it can be very fascinating when you're looking at some of the, the candidates that we're very aware of, and how they fell in relation to how their votes were transferred. Particularly if you look at, say, the likes of Eamon de Valera and, how well he won in his constituency in terms of votes. And he was able to bring in another running mate in with him who only got 114 votes because of the transfer of the surplus votes of de Valera. So yes, you can, but it does require a certain amount of ploughing through the newspapers to garner that information.
And did the electorate know how the system worked? I mean, this is a very complex electoral system on the face of it. So did this demonstrate that the public, you know, the electing public were up to speed, like, on how it worked?
You often saw commentary in the newspapers that they didn't, but actually they did. When proportional representation was introduced first, there was a lot of instruction given to voters on how to mark their ballot papers. And, model election demonstrations were actually given out in newspapers and things like that. So I would argue that the voting public was very aware of how to use proportional representation. The problem with proportional representation is sometimes it did annoy, certain parties or candidates. And we see that in their comments in the aftermath of elections, Cumann na Gael comment that proportional representation impeded them in 1923. But in actuality, it doesn't. It gives voice to certain other parties, as both Mel and Michael have commented on earlier. But no, people did know, in the same way that we know how to use it today, they did know how to use it then.
Michael, you want to come in on that point?
Yes, long ago when I was working on the 1922 election, going through local newspapers, I was able to work out the transfer of votes in every constituency in the country, of all the 21. So, yes, it is quite possible. It does involve a bit of slogging and basic work. It can be done, and the results are sometimes absolutely fascinating. In 1922, for example, you see a very clear case of pro-treaty candidates being ready to support third party, other pro-treaty candidates, rather than a Republican. And their transfers are of particular interest. And it's important to come back to the general figure, the pattern of 1922. 40% of first preferences went to third party candidates. Now, they didn't do as well proportionately in terms of seats that they won. But it was, in a, if you like, a repudiation of the two Sinn Féin factions. And maybe trailing my coat a little bit, some years ago, I said that the 1922 election could be seen in part as a repudiation of the Easter Rising and a repudiation of the War of Independence, because so many figures associated with them, Margaret Pearce, for example, just to take one, lost their seats. It's interesting that there was one candidate in the whole country who was deemed to be both pro and anti-treaty and who featured on both lists, Dan Breen in Tipperary. He wasn't elected, despite the fact that officially he was supported. He was too closely associated with the War of Independence, which was, at least among many voters, not a popular issue in 1922. It became so later, but not at the time in 22.
Now, just before I get on to the 23 election in more detail, Elaine, I want to just come back to you on a point. I'm sure many of our listeners have seen some marvellous photographs from the period have been reproduced, various publications. You know, these photographs of these huge public rallies and newsreels, you know, silent, obviously, newsreels. But, I mean, was this a bit like the Sermon on the Mount scene in The Life of Brian? You know, could people hear what was being said, and did it matter?
Yeah, the public rallies were huge in all of the elections of these eras. And they were the main form, really, by which candidates engaged with the public. And while there were other methods of propaganda, like newspaper editorials, advertisement posters and flags, and the all-important canvas, really it was speeches and public rallies. Radio and film were not as much used, because radio doesn't really begin broadcasting in Ireland until 1925 and 26 with 2RN, and films were silent until 1927. So really one of the only ways to engage with your audience or your voter was speeches. And these speeches were made in front of huge crowds. And crowd reaction in these speeches could be instantly measured. So, you know, candidates could, gauge the way the audience's reaction and use the content of speeches to measure that. Large crowd numbers were also seen as a sign of party support or public interest in a candidate. And even this was reported on in newspapers subsequently as well. But the difficulty is that, yes, if you have a large amount of people, there's no microphones in this era. So candidates are addressing large crowds who are not able to hear them. But that isn't really the point in terms of some of these big election rallies. The point is the ambience. They're there to actually experience the event. I suppose the best way to describe it is something like going to a concert to see your favourite band, but being at the very back and not being able to see them except on big screens.
My brother was a Woodstock, said he couldn't hear a thing. But anyway, that's beside the point.
but the point is, you're not necessarily going to see the band in actual personal form. You're going to experience the music and experience it with people around you. And you also have to bear in mind that there's very little public entertainment during these times. So, you know, electoral rallies were huge public entertainment arenas as well for people to go. So how did the candidate then get the message across to the audience? Well, now and again, you'd have people that would pass back messages through the audience. But generally speaking, really where the audience got to learn the actual policies of the candidates was in the subsequent editorial in either local or national newspapers. But the rally was a powerful area for to disseminate that message. And some were better than others at it.
Now, Michael, I want to move on to the 1923 election. How much of a milestone was that? Because all the seats were contested for the first time, were they not?
Yes, for the first time ever, with one possible exception in 1880, every seat was contested. Women, as we've said, had the vote now on exactly the same terms as men. And the Republicans were in utter disarray. They had lost the Civil War. 10,000 of their supporters were in jail. The odds were stacked massively against them. The government was totally confident it would have a walkover. And the result was, for them, for the members of the government, a massive setback. Sinn Féin did remarkably well. It won 27% of the vote, 6% more than in 1922. 44 Sinn Féin TDs were elected. In Kerry, which, of course, had seen some of the worst, most vicious fighting in the Civil War, Sinn Féin won 4 out of 7 seats. So it showed that republicanism, hostility to the treaty, wasn't dead, that Ireland was on the way to a two-party system, an effective two-party system. And I think one very important aspect of the 23 election is this. It showed some Republicans that politics could work. We've seen already, we discussed the fact that now in 22-23, proportional representation is used and the results are fairly representative. So a minority party wouldn't be wiped out as the Home Rulers were in 1918. Republicans, many of them took the view, yes, it is worthwhile persevering with politics, as some of them did in 1917 and 18, when they were converted rather reluctantly to politics. So in that way, it helped consolidate Irish democracy.
Just going back here, the 10,000 Republicans interned, were they able to vote, Michael?
No. Oh, no. No.
Okay. That's an interesting point, though. That's quite a lot of votes, you know.
A lot of votes.
Yeah. Now, can I just maybe, like, what was De Valera's attitude to this election in particular? Maybe, Mel, maybe you might come in on that point. I mean, did he embrace the whole election with gusto, or did he stand aloof from it?
Well, on the anti-treaty side, Tommy, there was a little bit of uncertainty initially as to whether the Republicans would participate in the election. Obviously, they'd had a very poor outcome in 1922. They knew that the electorate had, you know, voted broadly along pro-treaty lines before the Civil War. Obviously, they'd come out on the wrong side of the Civil War itself, as Michael outlined, you know, 10,000-11,000 of their most active, Republicans were still in prison after the Civil War. And the Republicans also, in the summer of 1923, you know, they weren't convinced that this election would be a free and fair contest. During the Civil War itself, leadership on the anti-treaty side really lay with the military people. De Valera and the sort of the political wing of the anti-treaty side became quite marginalised during the Civil War itself. So with the defeat of the anti-treatyites in the Civil War, De Valera was able to re-emerge and argue, you know, that the political path was the way forward. And there was some reluctance in that regard. And so to this end, he quickly, you know, set out to reorganize and essentially recapture Sinn Féin as an anti-treaty party. And in fact, a week after the Civil War, he wrote to Molly Childers to say, you know, that basically the formation of Cumann na Gael by the pro-treatyites, you know, leaves the way clear for Republicans to take over and reorganise Sinn Féin. And that's what happened in June 1923. But a month out from the 1923 election, it still wasn't clear, you know, whether Sinn Féin would participate in full. David McCullough, in his biography of De Valera, he kind of shows, you know, that there was some to-ing and fro-ing on this point. Would they field one candidate per constituency? Would they abstain altogether? Would they field candidates in constituencies where they were reasonably sure anti-treaty sentiment was strong? And in the end, it was actually the Sinn Féin Organising Committee that took the decision. I think it was on the 25th of July 1923 that they would contest the election in full. And they put up 85 candidates. And this, of course, meant the Free State government was going to face a very strong electoral challenge in every constituency.
Now, Mel, just talk to me about the formation of Cumann na Gael, because in 23 there are two distinct parties, which wasn't the case in 1922. So what bearing did that have on the outcome?
Exactly. No, that's very true. You know, in 1922, they're basically trying to stitch the band back together after the treaty split and the Dáil. But by the summer of 1923, you know, there's no return. You know, they've gone their separate ways. There's been a civil war. So as I said earlier, you know, the threat of civil war was in the air in 1922 when people went to vote. When people voted in 1923, the civil war had happened, and that was on the ballot. You know, the atrocities, executions, etc., was on the ballot. But in terms of Cumann na Gael was a quite an unusual political party in that it was already in government. You know, it had been when it was established. You know, it was already in power and had overseen the establishment of the state and the state's you know, conduct of the civil war itself. The impetus for the formation of Cumann na Gael came from the pro-treaty election committees that had been formed ahead of the June 1922 election, as outlined in Michael's book. So obviously, leadership on the pro-treaty side passed to W.T. Cosgrave after the deaths of Griffith and Collins. But Cosgrave and his ministers were really preoccupied with the civil war and the foundation of the state. And after the civil war, they're preoccupied with, you know, the dire state of the country's finances came into sharp focus. There was demands for land reform and the 1923 Land Act. So the actual formation of the party wasn't really high on the agenda of Cosgrave and his ministers. And Ernest Blythe really was the only government minister who took an active role in the formation of the party. And in fact, it was on the 7th of December 1922, there was at the height of the civil war, there was a conference in 5 Parnell Square. And at that meeting, the pro-treatyites in attendance decided to establish a political party called Cumann na Gael as a tribute to the organisation that Arthur Griffith had established in 1900 as a precursor to the original Sinn Féin. And there was actually some discussion about whether they would continue as Sinn Féin. And Blythe was quite forceful at that meeting in saying that Sinn Féin's work was done and, you know, it was time for a new political party. So, of course, people will know that on the 7th of December, the day of that meeting, was also the day that Sean Hales and Pádraic Cumáilí were attacked. And of course, Sean Hales was shot dead. And on the subsequent morning, you had the extrajudicial executions of Joe McKelvey, Liam Mellows, Rory O'Connor and Dick Barrett. So as a consequence of this, the public launch of Cumann na Gael was deferred. So it kind of shows you how the civil war really scarred the party right from the very beginning. So things had stabilized by the spring of 1923 to the extent that you know, the party were confident that a public launch could take place. This happened on the 27th of April, 1923 in the Mansion House. Now, again, you know, one issue here is that Cumann na Gael was a new political party. So they were starting from scratch there to set up branches and put in place structures. And the election was just, you know, 3-4 months away at this point, where Sinn Féin had the advantage of, you know, using a name that was familiar to people, you know, a going concern. You know, Cumann na Gael, you know, essentially had to try and build up the brand of the party in the summer of 1923. And in fact, one difficulty that they had, and you know, in 1933, American political scientist Warner Moss published a great book on free state politics, having spent time in Ireland researching the Irish political parties. And he made the point that a lot of Cumann na Gael's own supporters found it really difficult to even pronounce the name of the party, that it was quite a cumbersome party label. So, you know, these are just some of the difficulties that it faced. But of course, because of another disadvantage the party faced was that nationalism was now divided on the treaty. So they couldn't replicate what Sinn Féin had done in 1918. Obviously, they also had to stand over the civil war record. So essentially what they had to do in 1923, Cumann na Gael, they had to make inroads with, you know, the middle and professional classes who had been critical to getting the treaty passed in 1922. And this meant kind of appealing to voters anxious to avert a return to the violence and uncertainty of 1922. And this is what really informs the sort of sober, safety first message, you know, when they campaign as a cross-class national party that can deliver peace and stability. And this is really the Common na Gael message in the August 1923 election.
Now, mention has been made of another new party, the Farmers' Party. Martin, who or what were the Farmers' Party?
Yes, so I mean, the Farmers' Party was one of those smaller groups that was, I suppose, trying to appeal to voters that Mel would have talked about there as being in the eyes of Cumann na Gael when they were talking about sober and safety first. And obviously they were talking about the Land Act as well that was going to be aimed at farmers. But the Farmers' Party is a political party that arose from the Irish Farmers' Union. And this was an organisation that had been active during the First World War, representing farmers.
So what like type of farmers? Big, middle and small?
Well, their rhetoric would suggest, you know, appealing to farmers more generally. I think once you see Farmer Party TDs in the Dáil from 1922 and 1923 onwards, you would tend to see a tendency for them to represent larger farmers, more of the cattle farmers, if you like. But of course, this is playing on, I suppose, a longer legacy in Irish politics of land movements, of agrarian movements, which, you know, would aim to talk about agricultural communities and farming communities in a general sense. But of course, that overlooks a lot of the nuance of it. And that comes back to some of the Irish Party's agrarian movements as well, which were nominally aiming for all farmers, but perhaps, you know, could be dominated by larger farmers. And throughout the 1920s, then, the Farmers' Party certainly taxed to the right and taxed towards representing larger farmers. They are a party, though, that benefits from pulling on different political traditions. So, you know, Tony Varley has written about this, that if you look at the Irish Farmers' Union in the early 1920s, some of its supporters would have been former Home Rulers, some of its supporters would have been Southern Unionists, some of its supporters would have been Cumann na Gael supporters. And this is an issue that then, you know, Cumann na Gael tries to capitalise on when it adopts this safety first message. And as Mel has pointed out, as the 1920s go on, from the 1923 election on, Cumann na Gael is really trying to appeal to more professional middle class voters, to the larger farmers. They're trying to take away support from the Farmers' Party. They're trying to take away support from some of the independents, some of which might have Redmondite or Home Rule roots. And they're trying to, if you like, consolidate, I suppose, the sort of centre-right vote. But when you look at the 1923 election, we've discussed how it's a more peaceable election than 1922. And it's also an election where, whereas voters, as Elaine said, you know, developed very quickly an awareness of how proportional representation worked. But I think candidates and parties were still sort of engaging in some trial and error. And the combination of more peaceful circumstances and a greater familiarity with the nuances of PRS-TV meant that some of these independents and the Farmers' Party could do better. Labour probably didn't stand enough candidates in 1922 for the support that they gained. But in 1923, the farmers are the big winners. They go from 7 to 15 seats. I mean, in terms of 1922, of those 7 candidates, they had 3 of them had been representatives at local governments before 1918. In 1923, of its 15 elected TDs, 1 was a former Westminster candidate, Patrick McKenna. 6 had local government experience before 1918. And obviously, there's more seats available in Dáil Éireann now than there ever was in Westminster for Irish constituencies. They also attract others from former Home Rule backgrounds, like David Leo O'Gorman, who was a Cork Home Ruler, the former MP Hugh Law. And they're able to gain in constituencies, obviously, where you have these 7 and 9 seaters that you talked about. So, I mean, this was almost a purer form of PR than we have today, albeit it was very difficult to actually count the results in some of these constituencies where you have 7 and 9 seaters. So even looking at, and no farmer candidate is successful in Galway, for example, even though they poll just over 6% between 2 candidates. Conversely, when we look at the 9 seater in Galway in 1923, there's 5 candidates elected without getting 2,000 votes. So there's 5 candidates elected with under 2,000 votes, the bottom 5 of the 9, whereas the Republican Colm O'Guire actually gets over 2,000 votes. So clearly, at this stage, it's clear that if you're transfer friendly, you can get elected with a relatively low first percentage vote. And
Mark, tell me this, what happens to the Farmers' Party? Because they do fade out of the picture. Like, what happens to them and where does their vote go in later years?
So as the 1920s go on, and we can talk about 1927 in a second, but Cumann na Gael is very much trying to consolidate this vote. So Cumann na Gael is trying to appeal to the Farmers' Party. It's trying to gobble up the Farmers' Party. And it more or less succeeds in doing that, bar a handful of TDs. It more or less succeeds in sort of cannibalizing the farmers' vote. but it only to an extent, because there's a couple of TDs that don't, if you like, fully embrace, and it's not a full merger. And as soon as they start to win over Farmers Party voters and supporters, at that point, then the Redmondites try to reorganize. And in 1926, you have the National League set up by Captain William Redmond and Thomas O'Donnell. So, that you know, Kevin O'Higgins writes in some of his correspondence about this, about the difficulty of consolidating, you know, a sort of a pro-treaty vote that isn't necessarily a Cumann na Gael vote. And then in the 1930s, again, there's an emergence of another Farmers' Party, the National Centre Party. So it's an ongoing battle for Cumann na Gael. And it creates issues too, because obviously if they start to become associated with not just farmers, but former unionists or former home rulers, well, then this obviously calls into question the party's Irish Ireland credentials too. So it's a difficult balancing act for Cumann na Gael. It's one, obviously, that they struggle more to get right, I think, as the decade rolls on.
Now, you've mentioned Southern Unionists. Elaine, how did Southern Unionists do? I mean, where did their votes go?
Southern Unionists, well, a lot of Southern Unionists went into Shanadarran and were very active there. But in terms of running as electoral candidates, a number of ex-Unionists changed allegiance. And they ran in this election as various different types of candidates. For example, Major James Sproul Miles ran as an independent in Donegal and topped the poll there. And Major Brian Cooper ran as an independent. John Good ran for the Businessmen's Party and secured seats in Dublin County. And there were some unsuccessful unionist candidates as well, such as John Harley Scott, an independent in Cork, and Andrew Beattie, an independent in South Dublin. So they kind of absorbed themselves into more of the types of independent or businessman party, and some ended up in Cumann na Gael as well. So they were still there in Irish politics, but largely speaking on the Senate side, the Shannon side, than as candidates.
No, it's an irony there of Major Miles from my native Ballyshannon. He couldn't get elected when we were part of the United Kingdom. So he had to wait for the independent Ireland to come along with the PR electoral system for him to get elected. And he topped the poll then until into the 1940s. Now, Elaine, just another point I wanted to get to, because mention has been made here, several of you, of the 1923 Land Act. Could you just explain what was that Land Act about and why was it significant?
Yes, the Land Act came in 1923, and it really did benefit Cumann na Gael during this time. It passed into law on the 9th of August, and that was the same day that the Dáil was dissolved. And as Terence Dooley actually observed, it made good political sense to have a bill enacted before the election. But broadly speaking, this act confiscated estates from many landlords or subjected them to compulsory purchase orders. And this then allowed tenants to buy their own farms. So it was a coup for Cumann na Gael and for farmers generally. And I suppose in some ways this could explain how the Farmers' Party eventually dissolved in many ways, because Cumann na Gael absorbed a lot of them into their movements going forward. And then for the kind of weaker or poorer farmers, with the establishment of Fianna Fáil in 1926, who were appealing to the kind of more lower socioeconomic groups, they absorbed some of them, which eventually leads to the demise of the Farmers' Party. But the land bill was certainly a coup for Cumann na Gael.
Mel, you want to come in on that point?
Just very briefly, Tommy, just to say that there was actually a conference in April 1923, the Land Purchase and Arrears Conference. And at that conference, the tenants' representatives said, basically, you know, we now have political independence. I'm paraphrasing here. You know, we now have political independence. The people mean to have the land. If the government don't deliver on this, the next time we will put in a government who will. So that's the context to the drafting of the land of the 1923 Land Bill, subsequently the 1923 Land Act. It was really the signature policy of the government going into the election in that regard. And Dooley and Terence Dooley, in his book, he kind of outlines the, you know, for a state that was depleted of resources, the kind of the financial engineering that went into the actual working out of the 1923 Land Act, you know, was rather significant. It shows you what a priority it really was. He also links it to the end of the Civil War itself. You know, when, you know, it was made clear in the 1953 Land Act that those who were, you know, in armed opposition to the new government would be outside of its provision. So it really is a signature policy in 1923.
Elaine, you want to come back on that point?
I just want to say that even though the Land Bill was, or the Land Act was very important, it wouldn't have been the main themes of propaganda messages during this time in terms of talking about land. You know, you'd think that even, you know, Sinn Féin on the De Valera side would come in, but they were actually very much vehement about making the point that, and in a very forceful tone in their election manifesto, that, and I'll quote them, the propagandists who've been telling the world the base lie that the Irish people have, of their own free will, chosen to become a British, a partitioned British province, is really not the case, if you know what I mean. Like, and he draws on past historical figures to drive home that point. And Cumann na Gaeilge, as has been pointed out, and rightly so, really kind of attacked this campaign on the whole safety first issue. And to make points like to strengthen those who have brought peace to the nation. And Cosgrave very much alludes to, as has been pointed out, the idea of sorting out the financial difficulties in this volatile country because of past conflict. And the whole idea is to move towards a stable government. So the Farmers' Party even draw on all of that as well as the land issue, because they also are very interested in the political unity of the country, the prosperity of the country, and agriculture is their priority. But their statements are more akin to business-like statements when they say things like agriculture is the only wealth-producing industry in the country. And they make statements like, all other interests import, we export. So they very much drive home support of the treaty and the constitution, economic administration and agricultural interests. And of course, Labour are very much towards jobs and, you know, the stability of the economy as well. So it is really stability that is the key issue in the Farmers and Cumann na Gaeilge. And for, you know, De Valera's Sinn Féin, it's very much a repudiation of any agreement towards the treaty by 1923. So he is still arguing on the treaty at that stage.
Now, Martin, I just want to go on to you just before we wrap up, right, just moving beyond our brief here slightly to 1927. Now, there were two general elections in 1927. How have things changed by then? I mean, the obvious change is the formation of Fianna Fáil. But in general terms, what's the political lay of the land in 1927?
Well, I think that issue of consolidation that I mentioned previously, you know, has come to the fore, but it's also not fully resolved itself by 1927. So what you do have quite a series of by-elections between 1923 and 27 for various reasons, not least the army mutiny, where Joseph McGrath and others break away from Cumann na Gaeilge. And I think a lot of historians have argued that the net effect of this has been to see Cumann na Gaeilge move to the right, consolidate that support among, try to consolidate at least support among ex-home rulers, unionist voters, farmers voters. You have people with involvement in pre-1918 politics start to get elected in these by-elections for Cumann na Gaeilge, like James O'Mara, who's a former MP, Michael Egan in Cork, who had been associated with William O'Brien's All for Ireland League. But again, it's not fully successful because as long as the anti-treatyites stay outside of the Dáil, well, then the other treaty-supporting parties, if you like, are the official opposition. Labour, farmers, former Home Rulers, and there's now three former Home Rule MPs as independent deputies from 1923 on. There's William Redmond, John Redmond's son, who's hugely popular in Waterford in the southeast. There's Alfie Byrne, who's hugely popular in Dublin, the shaking hand of Dublin. And there's James Cosgrave in Galway. So there's quite a lot of room for criticism of the Cumann na Gaeilge government. And a lot of the criticism does come from the right. It's criticism on that the state is too extravagant, the public spending is too high. You get this from the Farmers' Party, you get this from independents. Obviously, Labour have different arguments from the left. And you have criticism of the government on this. You have criticism of the government on the pace of land reform. You have criticism on town tenants and the housing situation. Redmond takes up the role of defending the Vintners lobby, which some Irish Party MPs had done in the past. So you've quite a lot of flux still, despite Cumann na Gael's attempts to consolidate support among treaty supporters. And what you have in the build-up then to 1927 is you have the formation of new parties. The most famous and the significant one, obviously, is the formation of Fianna Fáil in 1926, which is where De Valera moves away from, if you like, the more of a focus on the treaty, the more of a focus on how can we possibly get support and move, petition people and move away from the Oath of Allegiance for entry into the Dáil. But you also have the formation, as I say, of the former Redmondites coming together in the National League Party, which is launched in the southeast in 1926. And it builds on the three independent deputies, but Byrne doesn't join. It also builds on Redmond anniversaries and Redmond commemorations and a sort of a movement there where people who are still loyal to Redmond, people who are still bitter about what happened in 1918, have scope to come out and speak. And you see this in the Senate elections in 1925 as well. For example, there's a quote from the National Secretary of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, John Dillon Nugent, where he reflects with satisfaction on the 1925 Senate election by quoting that in almost every county, strong and uncompromising opponents of the policy of murder, pillage and strife were returned at the head of the poll. It may be that they went forward to the electorate as farmers, business candidates, ratepayers, independents or the like. Be their designation what it may, those who were successful were in the main constitutional nationalists who emerged after a short retirement as the choice of the people. So there's very much this older home rule constituency that thinks it can make a comeback. But there's also, of course, some flux between the pro and anti-treaty sides as well. And Mel has written about this. So you have people who perhaps supported the treaty that are becoming disillusioned with Cumann na Gael, and maybe, you know, De Valera, by setting up Fianna Fáil as a new party, seeks to attract them. There's also Pádraic Ó Maolaodha is involved in Galway, is involved in Clan Éireann as a new party as well, to sort of bridge that gap. And there's a rhetoric around moving on from the Civil War. So what you get in the first 1927 election then in June is you get a real splintering of the vote, where a party like the National League emerges, gets 8 seats, and Cumann na Gael then is really, you know, it loses support in June 1927, and it looks quite a dangerous situation for Cosgrave, even though Fianna Fáil are still abstaining at that point. And then everything changes with the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins. So when after the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins, Cosgrave introduces legislation which really says that you can't just campaign to get the oath gone and still abstain. Obviously, the legislation he brings through in the aftermath of the assassination of O'Higgins, if you like, forces Fianna Fáil into the Dáil, and De Valera talks about the empty formula. And it's at that point then that probably the most unusual attempt at coalition government in the history of the state is attempted, with Labour and the National League coalition with the tacit support of Fianna Fáil. That brings up the rather amusing story of Alderman John Jinks from Sligo, who famously is absent on a vote of no confidence in Cosgrave. Cosgrave somehow survives on the cast-in vote of the Cean Comhairle, and that really discredits the old home rulers in the National League, because where they may have been disillusioned with Cumann na Gael, many of their supporters were hardly enthusiastic about a government where De Valera and Fianna Fáil were going to be involved. So 1927 is a critical year for the development of the party system. Cosgrave goes to the polls again in September 1927. The smaller parties can't financially support two elections in the 1 year. The National League is discredited. It gets reduced to 2 seats and it's almost bankrupt. And it's from then that you obviously have Fianna Fáil and Cumann na Gael, and you have a movement there towards two of the bigger parties. So if you like, there's this flux still and a rise of smaller parties in the June election, and by the September election, it's starting to become more crystallised about the civil war politics, if you like, what's called civil war politics, at least, even if there's more involved.
Well, that brings me to my final question, because what strikes me about what you talk about, the splintering of the political parties in 1927, it's a bit like what's been happening over the last 10, 20 years here. So in a sense, we're going back to the situation of the 1920s from the political system dominated by the two big parties. And this brings me to my final question in relation to the 2020 general election, which was seen as by many commentators as, you know, quote unquote, the end of civil war politics. Mel, maybe I'll bring you in on that one. Like, is that really the case? Were elections ever fought about the Civil War?
Well, I'm glad you came to me first, because something that I tend to rail against is this cliched term, civil war politics. Because if you look at, you know, if you look at 1922, look at the 1922 election and just see the evolution of these two parties that dominated Irish politics, we'll say up until the 2020 election, if I want to use that terminology. I mean, clearly, things were not fossilized in 1922 because of the ebb and flow of support of those two groups. You look at the anti-treatyite vote of 21%, we'd say, in 1922, the Sinn Féin vote of 27% in 1923. By, you know, 1932, the situation is very difficult. In my own book, I kind of say that the party system is something that, you know, settles over a 15-year period from 1922 to 1937. You know, obviously you have the evolution from, you know, Sinn Féin in the 1920s were criticised quite regularly for being a single-issue party, wait until the Republic is formed and then we can deliver. Obviously, when De Valera moved and formed Fianna Fáil, he tried to set up a big tent party that could bring, you know, a large section of the electorate with him. Then on the Cumann na Gael side, you have the accommodation with the Centre Party and the Blue Shirts in 1933. You have the formation of a new. So even the two political parties as they exist at the end of 1933 are different from the groups that represented the treaty position in 1922. So I think the, and in terms of obviously the echoes of the Civil War are there. I'm not trying to say they weren't. They were there certainly up until, say, the 50s, 60s. But I think Civil War politics is a bit of a cliche that really doesn't stand up to scrutiny, really. And just to make one final point, you know, if you look at Europe over the 20th century, or if you look at British politics, I mean, until recently, most European countries kind of had two dominant kind of broadly centre-left, centre-right kind of groupings. And I don't think Ireland was all that different in that respect.
Michael, I want to bring you in here and give us the last word on this.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Yes, I agree with what Mel says. Just one little comment or addition to it. Until the end of the 40s, say until the 48 election, elections were often fought for or against De Valera. Now, I know that's not the same as civil war politics, but it's not a world removed from it. And the 48 election is sometimes described as the first pork barrel election in Ireland, where economic issues, I would see the economic war as a political, not an economic struggle. In 48, economic issues were much more prominent. And then, a year later, it was Fine Gael, a Fine Gael-led coalition, that proclaimed the Republic. So things then, at the end of the 40s, became much more confused. De Valera, of course, carried on until 57, until he retired in 59. But by the end of the 40s, a lot of the venom had gone out of Irish politics, the venom that certainly characterises throughout the 1930s.
Okay, I'll leave Michael with the last word on that. I'd just like to thank our speakers, Elaine Callanan, Mel Farrell, Michael Laffin, and Martin O'Donoghue. And our next History Ireland Headstool, which will be it'll be posted next month, will be on the post-Civil War economy of the Irish Free State. And I hope you can tune in for that one, listeners. Thank you very much.